to begin with. In spite of the apostles' low evaluation of people who give out an uncertain sound, I must confess that I'm not quite sure what is meant by either part of the conference theme, the faith of the fathers, the language of the children. Probably the faith of the fathers is capable of more precise definition than the other thing, but both things require some clarification, I think, if we are to understand the topic. So let's try first off to be a little more specific about the faith of the fathers. What fathers are meant? If you mean the apostles, then their faith is pretty easy of definition. All you have to do is read the New Testament. But I suspect that the framers of this topic meant other and later fathers than the apostles. What fathers? Ante and post-Nicene, medieval, Reformation fathers, the founders of the Missouri Synod. Any historical, theological group, as you know, has certain theological slants, certain distinctive emphases that they give to the original deposit of the faith. And the Christian faith has always been colored by certain environmental factors, the personalities of the people involved, the racial and nationalistic tinge that's given to the controversy, if there is one, so that the faith always comes filtered through human beings. Even the New Testament is such a filtering. And so rather tragically, the faith is always acquiring certain accretions, so that in time, the difference between the original deposit of faith and what's accumulated around it, that distinction becomes rather difficult to make. Luther was one of those who was able to do it, to burn the canon law while at the same time clinging tenaciously to the gospel. But at what cost was the Reformation accomplished? A sundered Christendom, the 30 Years' War, St. Bartholomew Massacre, and everything that's happened since that time. It's a perilous adventure to try to chip away theological barnacles and get back to the original deposit. We have liturgical barnacles too. Richard Koenig, in his current series of articles, What's Behind the Showdown in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the Lutheran Forum, makes much of what he calls the Pieper tradition. And most of us have a fairly clear idea of what is meant by that phrase, the Pieper tradition, especially those of us who were here at the seminary when Pieper was here or shortly thereafter. It would, of course, be manifestly unfair, and Koenig isn't saying that in his article either, unfair to lay at Pieper's doorstep all the faults and failings that characterize Missouri today. What Koenig says there about the theological position of that time had certain reflections in the liturgical practices of that day, too. The intimate connection between doctrine and liturgy, which obtains at every point of the Church's history, is very clear in that era, which Koenig says came to a conclusion roughly around 1938. If the theology of the previous period was sterile, the devotional life of the Church was sterile also. The peculiar emphases or lack of emphases that characterized the Pieper theological tradition found their parallels in the liturgical traditions of that time. Now, it's precisely at this point that we must make a distinction between what is apostolic and Catholic on the one hand and what has been added to or subtracted from the faith on the other. Let me cite three examples, which are cases in point. The first example has to do with the Church's attitude toward the sacrament of the altar. If you think of Holy Communion primarily in terms of the forgiveness of sins, then that's going to affect your practice in several ways. Number one, your communion will be almost entirely an individualistic transaction between you and the Lord. Number two, you will be thinking about your sins, maybe as much as and even more than the forgiveness of the sins. Three, the fear of judgment will be involved in the thing. And here we think of that much abused passage about eating and drinking damnation to oneself. For going to the sacrament will be something of an ordeal, not to be endured too frequently. And five, the whole thing will be thought of as being a rather ponderous, oppressive, gloomy experience, which no doubt is why some parishes seem to think that the ideal time for Holy Communion is Good Friday. But if, on the other hand, you think of the sacrament predominantly as Eucharist, then some opposite things will happen. Number one, you will acknowledge the presence of the living Lord with joyful praise, and this will be expressed in the kind of hymns you sing, in the way the liturgy is chanted, in the whole attitude of the celebrating pastor. Two, since communion with Christ is to be welcomed rather than shunned, you will come to the table more frequently. Three, you will be conscious as you do this of the horizontal side of the experience as well as the vertical one, so that you commune not only with the risen Lord but also with his brothers and sisters. Four, you will begin to appreciate the very intimate connection between Holy Communion and the church year, so that no festival day, and no Sunday even, will go by without some participation in the sacramental feast. And five, you will think of Holy Communion as your food and drink along the way, the necessary spiritual sustenance of a pilgrim on the way to the Promised Land. Before going on to talk about the other two examples, let me interpose a few remarks about the shift just described. Those of you who have been in the ministry for a quarter of a century or more will know that this change, or any change in people's attitudes, is not brought about without some blood, sweat, and tears. And if you've been in the ministry only 6 weeks, you will undoubtedly have experienced the reluctance of many parishioners to change their devotional habits, their religious practices. Now, there was a time, you know, in the 20s and early 30s, when the average number of communions per member per year in our synod was around two. Some of us said to one another at that time, this isn't good. Something has to be done about it. And so we proceeded to persuade people, if we could, to change their habits about Holy Communion. And we tried to do this by increasing the number of celebrations, by attempting to make the liturgy and especially the music much more joyful, and by incessant preaching about the sacrament, stressing the Eucharistic note. In the course of time, little by little, some change began to take place. We haven't reached the ideal by any means, but we certainly have made some progress. Now, for a long time, after the inception of the liturgical movement, we kept telling ourselves that we were not asking people to change their beliefs, but only the expression of their beliefs. To put it another way, we felt that the great objective of the movement was simply to bring into prominence certain truths and practices which, for historical reasons, had become somewhat obscured. But many of the laity suspected that this was not the whole story. They reacted against liturgical change because they feared that the clergy were trying to change their religion. Somebody was tampering with their idea of God and with their relationship with this God. I used to protest that this was not so, that all we were trying to do was simply to highlight certain things that were in Luther's small catechism. But I've come to see that that was not entirely an honest response, and that what a lot of people were suspecting at that time had some validity. We were indeed out to change their religion. And though the intention, I think, in many minds was unformed, it was nevertheless there that we felt that people's idea of God need to be shifted. That intention was inarticulate, but it became more articulate as time went by, because a lot of us felt that the attitude of those early decades was defective, especially in regard to Holy Communion. So maybe now it begins to be clear why at the beginning of this paper I raised the question, what was meant by the faith of the fathers? Does this deserve to be perpetuated? Yes, if under the heading of Holy Communion you mean the apostolic and pre-Constantinian fathers. No, if you mean the Church of the Middle Ages. Yes, if you mean Luther in the early years of the Reformation. No, if you mean the Lutheran Church in the time of rationalism and pietism, which latter thing had strong echoes in the founders of the Missouri Synod. Yes, if you mean the beauty, joy, power, and fellowship, which are still becoming characteristic of our sacramental celebrations, one must discriminate in the choice of one's fathers. Not all traditions are equally healthy. And the force of this becomes still more clear when we consider the second example, and that is the shift that has taken place in our idea of the church. It's worthy of more than passing notice that those who have been involved in the liturgical movement have almost without exception been churchmen in a rather Catholic sense of the word. That means, for one thing, that they have had a strong sense of church history, the idea of a continuing body reaching back to the time of the apostles, a concept which, by the way, is going to find some rather startling reflection in the calendar to be published toward the end of the summer by the ILCW, a calendar which has in its list of people who may be commemorated people from every one of the 20 centuries. We had a little trouble with the eighth, but we finally came up with somebody. And not only that, but the calendar attempts to include representatives from various denominations, so that we have in that calendar such disparate figures as John Wesley and Pope John the 23rd. Now, such a thing would have been unthinkable 40, 50 years ago. And the mere fact that the suggestion is made today is symptomatic of the change that has taken place in our idea of the church. And here again you may say that it's not the doctrine that has changed, but only our articulation of it. But I would suggest to you that it's what you do about a doctrine that really reveals what you believe. And conversely, what you really believe shapes your practice. Thus, if you believe that the Lutherische Kirche ist die wahre sichtbare Kirche Gottes auf Erden, you will treat non-Lutherans accordingly, which lamentably often means as though they were not Christians at all. But if yours is a more Catholic view of the church, based upon the unitive concept of holy baptism and the famous Satis Est of the Augustana, then you will treat other Christians as your brothers in the faith, even though in some respects they may be in error. The perennial question, of course, always is, where do you draw the line? How much do you require of another man before you acknowledge him as a Christian brother? This is a way of putting the question which is agitating our synod at the present time. It's not a new question, of course, but the historical developments, especially the Americanization of our church, require the answer to be put in a new way. For a long time, the cultural and linguistic insularity of our people meant that they thought of the church in terms of their own peculiar island. But gradually, as the experiences of our people grew, as they learned to speak English, and as they became Americanized, as a new generation grew up that knew neither Stefan nor Walter, this caused them to think of the church in broader terms. Sometimes, indeed, this is slopped over into indifferentism, so that people began to say here and there, it doesn't make any difference what you believe. But on the positive side, what happened was that theologians from various denominations began to talk with one another across these denominational lines, especially biblical scholars, and more especially in the Old Testament field, achieved a remarkable camaraderie. Historians began to readjust their prejudices. Even dogmaticians got into the act. And when the great thaw occurred in the Roman Catholic Church, then people saw that a very remarkable thing was taking place. And the churchmen were ceasing to damn one another for their errors and we're engaged in a common quest for the truth. And we're doing it, for the most part, in the spirit of loving community. All glory be to God. Liturgiologists likewise discovered that they were interested in the same things, so that if you were to put in parallel columns today the Eucharistic rites of the three major Western liturgical churches, Lutheran, Anglican, Roman Catholic, you would see at once not only that there was a very similar structure, but that in many instances the very words and phrases were the same. So that today, it is not at all uncommon for Lutherans to use an Anglican canon, or for Lutherans or Anglicans to use a Roman Catholic canon, with only some rather minor changes. And this has led some people to ask, to reason, that if Christians can agree on what is to be said and done when they get together to worship God, why can't they do it together? In other words, what barriers remain to intercommunion? I simply refer you at this point to the published answers to that question, the reports of the Lutheran Roman Catholic series of dialogues that have been going on, and the more recent Anglican Lutheran dialogues. Now, it's quite understandable in such a context that some individuals would jump the gun, would not wait for official approval for intercommunion. In some situations that I know, that I've heard of, and that have had to do with intimately, people have almost forcibly refrained from doing this, and the refraining has been painful because they have felt that this was not the way the Lord meant things to be, that they should be divided at this point. There are occasions when people feel that it's almost monstrous not to commune together. Now, when people have communed together, consider then what this means. It means that these people have found it possible to discover and even to implement that Spirit-created unity on a level that is different from the level of complete doctrinal agreement. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating that way of solving problems of church union, but I am saying that when theologians who are conscientious and responsible feel themselves at one with brethren of other denominations and are moved to express that in sacramental fellowship, they should not be condemned for doing it. Now, I'm quite sure I wouldn't have said that 40 years ago, and even more sure that at that time I would not have received Holy Communion from anybody but a Synodical Conference Lutheran. And I simply offer that as a small piece of evidence, and maybe some of you could say the same thing, of how far we have come in our thinking about the church. Now, some indeed will think that this change is not progress but retrogression, that it's a sign of doctrinal indifferentism. I don't believe that that charge is justified, but rather, I believe that this is a practical and sometimes courageous implementation of the New Testament teaching about the church. And even more than that, I would go so far as to say that those who would restrict communion to Missouri Synod Lutherans are bordering on heresy as far as their doctrine of the church is concerned. So much for the second example of how the Missouri Synod tradition has been affected by the changing times. Now, at the root of both these changes, the one about the sacrament and the one about the church, at the root of both of them is a different idea of God. Now, God, of course, is always the same. But anybody who is honest with himself and who looks back over his own experience of God, I think will not say that the way he thinks about God today is precisely the same as the way he thought about God 50, 40, or even 30 years ago. We are children of our age, and as the age has changed, so have we, at least somewhat. It's been said over and over again that God has become progressively unnecessary to us in our time. Certainly it's true that he's not as prominent in the thinking of any of us as he was in the thinking of some of our pious ancestors. In the experience of millions, months and even years go by without even a thought of God. And yet, the deeply rooted religious instinct of man keeps asserting itself in strange and sometimes horrible ways. Zen Buddhism, black Muslimism, the drug culture, devil worship, and more close to home, the Jesus people and the charismatic movement are all manifestations of this basic human longing for something better than can be found on a purely human level. And as we contemplate all of that, these very variegated aberrations from the Orthodox Christian way of life, we must ask ourselves where we have failed to turn people off from the organized mainline church in these ways. And I believe the answer to that and the reason for some repentance on our part is a twofold one. First, we have failed to convey an awareness of this majestic God that we serve. And secondly, we have failed to give the world a living illustration of the love of the Christian family. Let me try to spell these out. As to the first, the doctrinal, the orthodox, the pedagogical strain in our tradition has caused us to shy away from anything that smacks of mysticism. We have put this down as some manifestation of schwärmerei and have tended to place all our chips on the educational process, on being experts in doctrine. And there has been some intimation in that God can be understood, categorized, defined on the pages of a textbook in dogmatics. And it somehow escaped us that God cannot be understood, that he is to be worshipped, and that while cognition is indeed an important element in that worship, the main thing is the attitude of the soul. And that's what the liturgical movement has always sought to foster, not always successfully and up some blind alleys here and there, but nevertheless always sensing that the object of the game was to bring men into a deeper, fuller, richer communion with God. In this quest, liturgically minded churchmen have enlisted the various arts, architecture, needlework, graphic art, and Sunday bulletins, and banners, and posters, painting, sculpture, metalwork, and above all, music. And central to all of these artistic strivings has been the conviction that God is not only a God of truth, whose teachings must be accurately known, but also a God of beauty, who is to be worshipped with the finest expressions of the human genius. It's significant that the journal of the Lutheran Society for Worship, Music, and the Arts is called Response, because that word response characterizes the whole drive of this thing, the response of men to God's forgiving grace in Jesus Christ. It's noteworthy, again, that 30, 40 years ago, there wasn't a journal like this, nor was there a society to publish it. The church of that era was a cultural wasteland from which we have happily begun to emerge and into which we must not allow ourselves to sink again. And so we have come to think of God in different ways. We hear him saying the same things to us, but in altered accents. We say the same things to him, but in different language and using different music. And that brings me at long last to the other part of the conference theme, the language of the children. Let me say at once that I don't think, for my part, that the language of the children is any improvement over the language of the fathers. I am fuddy-duddy enough to think that none of the many Bible translations which have appeared can match in beauty King James. I think that Wacket Auf and the Grosser Glaube are far better hymns than the Lord of the Dance. I much prefer the 23rd Psalm to Bridge Over Troubled Waters. I think that the choir of King's College Chapel is much more pleasing to Almighty God than the Beatles. I take a dim view of a church service in which the Word of God is drowned in a flood of cacophonous noise. In short, I am a liturgical conservative, which of course always goes hand in hand with being conservative doctrinally. But we must accept the facts of life. And the facts are that we no longer speak Elizabethan English. that the old Lutheran chorales are less known and I think less loved every passing year. That as time goes on, dignity, reverence, appreciation for the church and her history are becoming more and more minimal. So what do? We used to insist on maintaining our linguistic, musical, and cultural standards, and to say that it was the task of the professionals in the church to raise the taste and appreciation of the people for these better things. Now, I may not have my ear close enough to the ground, but it seems to me that this point of view is giving way to the opinion that we must reach people on their own level and let the cultural standards be damned. Joseph Fitzer sums up a similar Roman Catholic reversal by saying in the recent issue of Worship, "Mother Church turned away from cultural education. She reversed herself and, well, let in the mob. Or rather, in the power of the God who became man, she let herself grow in wisdom and grace in the ways of contemporary men." Now, these are two ways of putting it. If you choose the first, the part about letting in the mob, you lay yourself open to the charge of being a snob. If you choose the second, the thing about the incarnation, you sound a lot more Christian, and maybe you are. But you also open the door to a flood of cheap art, lousy music, poorly structured and maybe even ungrammatical liturgy, the result of which will be that people of sensitivity will be turned off even more from the church. So I ask you once more, what do? Perhaps it will help to note Dr. Fitzer's contention that we must deal with the fact of 20th century pluralism. In other words, we cannot any longer expect everybody to be comfortable with the same liturgy, music, or art. Contemporary society operates on different levels, and these are reflected in the variegated parishes of the church, all the way from the sophisticated community at the University of Chicago to some parish out in the prairies of eastern Colorado. There's a peculiar black culture, and there are still numbers of people who like Bach. One congregation in St. Louis clings to the old green hymnal of the Missouri Synod, and other congregations use everything that's put out in print. All this seems to add up to the phenomenon that the church is giving up the ideal of a monolithic liturgy and liturgical music and hymnody too, and is learning to be all things to all men. And looking at this theologically, it's difficult to come up with any objection to it. It's difficult to come up with any objection to it from the standpoint of a communicator, because if you assume that a communication gap exists and that those who have been turned off from the church are not likely to do anything to bridge that gap, then certainly the church must do it or it's not going to be done. And so we are driven to the conclusion that it's the church that must take steps to deal intelligibly with the people of our time. And if that means liturgical, musical, and artistic pluralism, so be it. We may not like it, but we have our job to do. We continue to serve the God of beauty and to be obligated to bring beautiful sacrifices to him. And that means, it seems to me, that in our efforts to reach people where they are, we must at the same time try to raise their sights, to enlarge their appreciation and to move them a step or two along the way. Simply to settle for whatever exists is deadening. If you are not concerned to improve the situation, then you have become defeatist. The movement for church renewal definitely includes a continuing drive for new life in what is said and done in the church, and as far as the environment in which all this takes place is concerned. At this point, I'd like to make a plug for the publications of the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship. I do that for one reason, because the record of the Missouri Synod, or at least of Concordia Publishing House, the sales record, has been very poor. And that's particularly deplorable when you remember that the ILCW was formed at the instigation of the Missouri Synod. As of last November, the sales record looked like this. CW1. Contemporary Worship 1, that's that first volume of hymns. By the way, there is available this binder for these things if you don't know that. You can get it for a buck. So Contemporary Worship 1 was this collection of 23 contemporary hymns. The sales record of that was Augsburg, 119,000, Fortress Press, 50,000, Concordia Publishing House, 16,000. CW2, which is the Eucharistic liturgy with the four musical settings, Augsburg, 144,000, Fortress, 101,000, Concordia, 14,000. Now, part of the explanation for this, maybe a large part, is the intervening worship supplement and the fact that a lot of congregations, having bought the worship supplement, didn't want to buy another booklet and confuse people still further. But can it also mean that our conservative slip is showing a little bit? The ILCW has made a consistent effort to be contemporary without being cheap. That is to try to retain some hold on the old traditions of the church, but also, and more importantly, to say things in the language of our time, both verbally and musically. Accordingly, the commission has endeavored to give the heritage a thorough shaking and sifting so that the things which cannot be shaken might remain. Thus, it took for granted that the chief service of the church would be one in which word and sacrament both were used, but assumed that both of these parts were open to radical revision. It assumed that in the sacrament part, the fourfold shape of the liturgy would be retained, according to Dix's book, but it undertook to make the outline of this clear and distinct, adding to or subtracting from the Lutheran hymnal or the service book and hymnal as necessary. It accepted the church year as a given, but not as something not open to restructuring. There was no hesitancy about reading the Bible. Neither was there any hesitancy about accepting the idea of a three-year cycle of lessons. The collects, too, were part of the ancient tradition, but the collects almost begged for simplification. The Psalms, too, would continue to be a valued part of the church's prayer, but in a modern translation and in a different way than the snippets of Psalms that are found presently in our introits and graduals. And when you speak of the introits and graduals, the question must arise whether these are still viable, useful in the modern church, or whether they should not, in the language of our Roman Catholic friends, be suppressed. In all these matters, other questions arose. To what extent should we cooperate with European Lutherans, and to what extent with English-speaking Christians of other denominations? The ecumenical aspect of the ILCW's work is to be seen in its leadership in sponsoring the CCT, the Commission on Common Texts, which texts are found in the worship supplement, and in the later representation on the ICET, the International Commission on English Texts, which has produced updated versions of the liturgical elements. By the way, if you don't have this, you should. Prayers we have in common. And if you don't have it, get this yellow copy, which is the second edition, and which has some revisions of the first edition and some additions to it. That's Fortress Press.
Might that be in the bookstore here, do you know?
Yes, I'm sure it will be. Mm-hmm. Five booklets, as you probably know, have appeared from the ILCW. The two I've already referred to, the hymns, the Eucharistic liturgy. Three is the marriage service. Four is hymns of Holy Baptism and Holy Communion. Five is services of the Word, seasonal, and then two general ones. At the end of summer, hopefully, or at least early fall, CW6 will appear, and this will include some highly important material. First, the calendar, which will include, as I said before, a greatly expanded sanctoral cycle. Then the three-year lectionary, together with selections from the Psalter to be used in between the lessons, sometimes whole psalms with congregational responses included. An essay explaining these first two items is number three. Four is prayers for the day and season, that is, collects in their revised form. I don't know whether you're going to like this or not, because you tinker around with the collects and you simply destroy their old structure. 5 would be the one-year lectionary, which has been available for some time now through our Commission on Worship, a revision of the present lessons, you know. And lastly, a concordance to the lectionary. It's the understanding then at the ILCW that all Lutheran calendars will, beginning with 1974, include the revisions that have been made to the church year, like the elimination of the Jesimus Sundays, the elongation of the Epiphany season, calling these Sundays right now Sundays of Easter, and in the green part of the year, Sundays after Pentecost rather than after Trinity, and some other minor revisions. It's also the hope of the ILCW that Lutheran parishes across the continent will begin to use the three-year cycle of readings beginning this Advent. Work is proceeding on the initiation rites, baptism and confirmation, and on the burial service. And beyond that, at its November meeting, the Commission arrived at some notable decisions. A twofold resolution was adopted, namely that the ILCW hymn text and hymn music committees proceed with the preparation and publication of a hymn book to include no more than 400 hymns by 1975-76. And that the liturgical texts and liturgical music committees continue with the preparation and evaluation of orders of congregational worship for publication in a congregational worship book by 1976-77. An interpretation of this action was inserted into the minutes that these dates referred to the completion of the manuscript, not to the publication in print. Also, the Commission made it clear that it had not opted for either a one-volume or a two-volume thing. That is, whether we are going to continue, as we have for a long time in the past, with having the liturgy and the hymns in one book, or whether we would go the Anglican route of having the liturgy in one book and the hymns in another one. That's still up for grabs. Now, in the meantime, it will certainly be of great value to the Commission to receive criticisms and evaluations of published materials. There is in existence an evaluation sheet for the Eucharistic Rite in CW2, and if you want that, just write into Delaney's office for it, and he'll be glad to send you a copy. Under the head of further reporting, I might add that at the March meeting of the Liturgical Text Committee, not the Commission now, the Commission has not yet approved this, but the following table of contents was suggested for the liturgical part of this book or books. It was said that it should contain the common service in updated language, maybe like no more updated than what appears in the worship supplement. And that should appear in two settings, whatever they may be. Maybe the second setting in SBH, maybe Healy Willen, maybe the page 15 setting, I don't know. Secondly, CW2, the Eucharistic setting, again with two musical settings, and probably these would be the second and the fourth. If you're familiar with that, the second one is the hymnic setting by Nelson up in Minneapolis, and the fourth one is the guitar setting by John Elbazacher. Third, the propers, that is the lessons, selected psalmody, collects, then the calendar, the baptismal service, the rite of private confession, the litany, at least one service of the word, matins, the noon service, vespers, the night service, compline, and in all of this, only the melody line of the music. The accompaniment, the harmonization would then appear in another volume. Now, brethren, all of this, of course, is just the nuts and bolts of worship. This is just grist for the mill, and it's the job of the Commission to provide this stuff. But where the tire really hits the road is where you fellas are. What the pastor, what the congregation, what the organist, whoever is responsible, does with all this stuff. You're concerned, most of you here, with the obligations of the pastor here. Let me say, first of all, and I hope you won't take offense at this and think that it's, really unnecessary to say it, but I think that a pastor should, first of all, be a man of God. And I say that because it is possible for a pastor to be a successful man in the usual American sense of the word success without genuinely being deeply a man of God. He may be a masterful organizer. He may have a pleasing personality. He may be able to persuade people to do certain things. He may get all sorts of projects on the road. He may have a bang-up every member visitation program and all of this stuff. And in all of it, he has not succeeded in becoming a real worshiper. Now, I realize that one must be exceedingly careful about making judgments about this. But I think one indicator that might tell you something would be the indicator of a pastor's liturgizing and his preaching. What does he say, and how does he say it? What does he do, and how does he do it? Is it all carried on in the spirit of reverence, or does one get the idea that maybe this is a kind of an ecclesiastical business meeting? Is there a certain suggestion of superficiality or formalism or unthinkingness? It gives the idea that this is sort of a off-the-cuff throwing together of heterogeneous elements, or is the whole thing, I hesitate to use the word, a really professional job? And what I mean by professional is that there's a very deep piety behind this and also a considerable amount of know-how. Perhaps we might formulate a general rule to be followed by all who lead the worship of God's people, and that rule would be, consider what you are saying. You know, over and over again, we say the most tremendous things in church. I forgive you your sins. You alone are most high in the glory of God the Father. Heaven and earth are full of your glory. He was incarnate by the Holy Ghost of the Virgin Mary. By his death he has destroyed death. And by his rising to life again hath restored to us everlasting life. Heaven and earth are full of your glory. This is my body. This is my blood. The most amazing things that anybody could possibly say. But we say them so often as though they meant not very much at all. Maybe it's just because we do say them so often that they come out that way. So much the more reason then to discipline ourselves to think of what we are saying, and to say it as though we meant it, which hopefully we do. There can be, at best, only a limited escape from tradition. You may come up with new liturgies, and you may teach the congregation new chants and new hymns and so forth, but still, essentially, our job is to do the same things over and over again, week after week. To do these things, to say these things reverently, is difficult, but not impossible. Much can be accomplished if we fortify ourselves by prayer. We had a fellow in here yesterday who said he goes to church 2.5 hours before the service starts. I don't quite know what he does all that time, but I do think that a person ought to be there at least a half hour, not only to put the ribbons in the right places, in the missal and in the Bible and so forth, but to pray about this thing that he's going to do. Okay, then presently he starts to do it. The service begins, the pastor does his thing. And as he does it, he walks on a tightrope between sentimentality on the one hand and a mechanical droning on the other. I don't know exactly which is worse, but maybe the latter thing, the mechanical droning, is more common. Last fall when I was here at the semi, I had a chance to worship in other churches. And a couple of times I was positively appalled by the unthinking rattling off of liturgical texts. I thought once in a while of how shocked Luther was when he got to Rome and was bawled out by some priest there for saying the Mass in more than 20 minutes. And maybe a little bit we've got into that same frame of mind, of saying these things just so they are said, you know, ex opere operato, and saying them not too slowly because the parking lot has got to be cleared for the next service, you know. Well, maybe that's being judgmental. Let's say something about the other side of it. Some clergymen are sentimentalists by nature, and it's very difficult for them not to be schmaltzy in church. It's okay, so it's hard. But a good antidote for that and for other liturgical deficiencies as well, might be, if we could arrange it, to expose ourselves to the very honest and blunt criticism of another pastor. That's hard to arrange. Maybe we could, once in a great while, put ourselves on videotape. I understand that portable videotape machines are now coming on the market. But we all have audio tape, and we could listen to ourselves once in a while. We couldn't, of course, see ourselves, and postures and gestures are an important part of worship, too. The pastor must know when to stand, when to sit, when to kneel, how to move around from one place to the other, what to do with his hands, when to go to the altar, when to stay away from the altar, and all this. But such skills, like reading properly, come under the heading of techniques to be learned and used. And, of course, it's the job of a professional churchman to become expert in this. And if he does not know his stuff as a leader of corporate worship, then I imagine that anybody of sensitivity who observes him will see this very clearly and may even put him down as kind of an inept bungler. We don't want anything like that to be said or thought about us. But yet, even if we should have sharpened our skills in these areas to razor point, we might still lack the indispensable basis of genuine spirituality. It's possible to be a liturgical expert without having the soul of a worshiper. How does one learn to worship in depth? How does one cultivate the spirit of adoration? Can one really become lost in wonder, love, and praise, especially when you're conducting a service and you must think not only of what's going on right now, but of what you have to do next? It's a hard thing to do. Well, there's one road, I think, that leads into that direction. There may be others, but the main road, I think, is the road of prayer. In prayer, we open ourselves to God, and through meditation, we discover for ourselves more and more of his truth and beauty and power and love, his peace and his joy. The church year teaches us much about this, the Eucharistic life still more, and if one is fortified through the week by use of the divine office, that's to the good also. All of this is done in the context of the church, which is the veritable body of Christ. And so living and so praying, it should be possible for even comparatively shallow spirits to be drawn into the immense sea of fellowship with the Lord and all his matchless goodness. And like pastor, like people, you know, in the course of time, a worshiping pastor will lead at least a few people into a more ample worship of God than they have ever known before. And that is the object of the whole enterprise. So we have a few moments, maybe about 8 minutes, for remarks, questions. Reuben?
One question, Herb. So much of the newer literature that is coming out, they continue to use the word everlasting instead of eternal. Wouldn't the word eternal be a little more correct than the word everlasting?
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, yeah.
Is anything being done to it, right? In my own practice, I always omit the word everlasting and substitute eternal.
Okay.
Are you doing anything in this in the commission?
I don't recall exactly. I'm quite sure that what you're saying has been generally adopted. I can't say for sure, but check it through and what's already appeared. Have you done that? Are we sticking with everlasting?
Yeah, everlasting.
Okay. Everlastingly, huh? Here's a note.
Question.
Excuse me, just a minute. Here's a note for Reverend Daniel Cook. Is he here?
Has anything been done to encourage the Tibble House to become a little bit more concerned about liturgical practices? I pick up a Tibble House catalog and I'm actually almost a little bit offended by the huge parade of jitters that they display rather than a sensible common chalice. Seems to me that Tibble House is often catering
Some years ago, when the Tittle House got together, various committees that were concerned with education matters, that group recommended that the Tittle House employ an individual who would make this whole field his baby, you know, be an expert on it, but they never did anything about it.
Herb, I got two questions there. Number one, what's happening in the progress of some churches to set Easter on a set date?
That's sort of on a dead circle. I moved from it. Most of the great church groups have at least expressed themselves as being not opposed to this, and that would include Roman Catholic people, the World Council of Churches, I think the American Council of Churches, and our Lutheran Commission also here in this country. But nobody does anything. I guess the logical person really to take the lead would be the Pope. But he doesn't do anything either.
Second question. These other booklets are coming out. What effect will they have in this old All-Lutheran hymnal of 1980, or is that down the drain?
Well, that's what the resolution is shooting toward. These books, the 400 hymn book and the liturgy book, I don't think either of them would appear much before 1980. If there's just one book in there, that's it.
This is the one that you're talking about for years, 1980?
Right. Now, I haven't been close to this hymn thing. I get the impression that the commission wants to hold down the hymn book to 400 hymns for two reasons. First, because these then would be hymns that everybody agrees should be in a hymnal. No question about it at all. But that beyond that, any hymns that you might want to use in a congregation could be mimeographed or whatever you want to do about it. But if we want to come out with a hymn book that would serve all sorts of cultural and ethnic groups that exist in this continent, it would be a huge hymnal. And I don't think the commission even wants to try to do that. It feels that it's an almost impossible task.
Probably the other thing, though, the other alternative, though, Herb, is that we end up being cluttered with all sorts of things in our pew rack. And, you know, I got to the point in Glenelg, you know, where I had to promise people we were going to put a lectern in every pew, you know. Because they, you know, I sympathize with the fact that we had to be careful that we didn't introduce, you know, do too many different things at the same time. Because, good heavens, the people had to handle this and that and the next thing because you didn't have the liturgies available. Now, couldn't there be some sort of a compromise on this if you can't have all of the hymns that are part of the heritage? Can't there be a little bit more of a breadth variety? I'm a little dismayed. You hear, you know, 400 hymns. I think we ought to be going in the other direction. Unless we're getting rid of some of the bad ones and bringing them far away.
You know, even that is tough. Here at the seminary last fall, one issue of the seminar was written entirely by black students. And they complained, two or three of them, that everything that happens over here in the chapel is Germanic. Mm-hmm. It just isn't our thing at all. Black culture ought to be represented. Well, okay, there are other groups in the country too that could say the same thing. Spanish American people. I don't know, I think it gets to be pretty tough. I think the black students have a legitimate complaint that nothing the quarter that I was here that happened in the chapel was slanted in their direction at all. This is the problem. That's why I say we have to, I think, settle for it. A certain pluralism, so that it might be possible that as a supplement to this core hymnal, 400, there would be various other supplements that could be purchased, used, depending upon what kind of congregation you had.
Can I hear you say that there was a general acceptance of the new lectionary, 3-year series?
In the commission, yeah.
queries of human people like it. It's amazing how much better attention they pay during the meeting election. I hear something.
And the three lectionaries now will be, well, more than similar. They will be, in most cases, identical. Roman Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran. There are some deviations. There was considerable discussion in the Lutheran Commission about whether we could make use of the apocryphal books. The commission finally said no. But they wanted to know what the apocryphal readings are, why you can get them through the many books. If you want to use that sort of thing.
Where is this available? CD's got it.
What, the 3 years?
Yeah. Is that available?
No, it's not. It's not in print yet.
Oh, I see.
They sent it out.
Yeah. Oh, you can get it in mimeograph form. And the 1 year thing, which is a revision of the old cycle, has been available for some time.